It's showtime.
Kincaid, 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bycod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy. So this program is live, broadcasting live, as a matter of fact, from a secure, undisclosed location somewhere in the general area of Washington, D.C. This is The Horn. HeadOn.live is where you'll find us on the interweb tubes. And if you want to be part of the merry, madcap, wacky, zany, real-time multimedia extravaganza that is the chat that takes place during the 3 hours in which this program is live, Monday through Friday, 6 to 9 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time, 3 to 6 p.m. Pacific Daylight Time, well, just head on over to headon.live and click on chat room, pick yourself out a screen name and a password, and you will be immediately welcomed by the likes of Anatole and Jimmy and Otto DeShot and Squeaky, and capably moderated by longtime, inveterate, indefatigable veteran chat room moderator, Sparky, who, although a spacing guild master of much talent, has chosen to remain Sparky and not fold space to become Man Cave this evening. They're out in Northern California. My goodness gracious, I haven't seen this guy in a while. Our buddy Parson Brown just wandered into the chat room. Hey, Parson, good to see you. We've got big doings. We got big doings here in the on the House of Representatives side of the Congress this week. Of course, my colleague Bo Webb and I are up here to work on the Appalachian Communities Health Emergency Campaign and the AHCE Act itself. More on that in just a moment. But we're going to start the program as we always start the program, and that is with gratitude. Thanks to our subscribers for the first of the month. Thank you to Rocco, and thank you to Elizabeth. Thank you, Reggie. Thank you, David. Thank you, Colin and Ralphs and Rusty and Terry in Amherst, where only the H is silent. Thanks to Peter, and thanks to our buddies at Home Dirts, and thanks to Lauren up in far frozen Canada. Thanks to Smitty, Joseph. Thank you, one and all. And a reminder. Thanks to our buddy Laborman and Ralphs, and an anonymous individual who wishes to remain anonymous. Well, we have Shirley's Memorial Challenge on the table for this first broadcast of the month of April. That's right. There's $200 in matching funds available. So if you want to double your contribution dollars, this is a great night to be doing it, because every dollar becomes two. Every five becomes 10, every 10, 20, 20, 40, 50, 100, 102, up to $200. So if you, if you'll jump in on that, then you've got a chance to, really stretch, your contribution to keep The Horn on the air and going. So maybe we can work on that. If you do want to participate, if you want to participate in the challenge, just run over to headon.live, click on, contribute, and you'll be off and running. Hey, how does the new rig sound? Because that's another thank you that needs to go out. Thanks to everybody who participated in the equipment fundraiser. The gizmo, everything appears to be working well from this end. I just had a note from Agnes, the Viking warrior pharaoh princess, who tells me that it sounds good on her where she is. So that's encouraging. A note coming in from Scott in San Diego. Live and direct from Disneyland on the Potomac, 62 square miles surrounded by reality. Head on live stream is good. And yeah, there's not going to be anything on the White Rose. I should have mentioned it. There's not going to be anything on the White Rose stream simply because I don't want to ask too much of either the internet connection or the processing power here, because there's a lot of stuff there's a lot of stuff hooked up and making demands of it. You want to hear one of the cool things the new gizmo does? Check this out. Yeah, isn't that cool? Rimshot. And a harp. Yeah. I got a feeling we're going to have some use for that one right there. Like, say, any time that we're talking about you-know-who. Mm-hmm. So, and by the way, just in terms of how stuff works, all of our connectivity that we have in the studio back at the in the fabulous Horn Studios at the magnificent Kincaid Mansion is available here. So if you want to reach the program via Skype, you can do that. Same old Bob Kincaid Horn on Skype. If you want to call the stress line, you can do that too. Area code, no, not area code, 844-THE-HORN, 844-THEHORN, 844-843-4676, and it all comes through. Different microphone this time. Sounds pretty good. The audio sounds pretty good in my headphones. Thank you very kindly, Sparky, in the chat room, letting me know. Sounds good, Bob. Sparky has been saying it's time for the shoe leather report. Well, there's no shoe leather involved because I guess even dress shoes are made with some sort of synthetic substance now. But we put a few miles on, Bo and I have, since yesterday morning. And I think it's going to bear fruit. In fact, I've got Bo here. We'll be chatting here in a couple of minutes, just talking about, because it's not very often that you get two people who know more about a given piece of legislation than just about anybody else in the country in the same room at the same time. So I thought that that would be a good conversation to have. It's, of course, Trump-tanic Tuesday, full steam ahead into the iceberg, and we've got some manifestations of Trump-tanic intellect, the likes of which, every day is just a new, it's just a new adventure in insanity. So we'll get into that as well. As far as other program notes, I'm not sure when, I mean, maybe tomorrow. I'll be on. This won't be the only day I'm on the air this week. And also, as a bonus, Thursday and Friday, the 4th and the 5th, the Malloys are gone for spring break, so I'll be covering for Mike Thursday night and Friday from 9 to 10 this week. And you'll be, and we can check, and you can check it out that way. Well, we'll be having more conversation that way. A reminder over at MikeMalloy.com, if you want to participate in Malloy Fest Part 2, the adventure continues. The link is over there at MikeMalloy.com, and the stuff you need to fill out. Spaces are filling up fast, so if you do want to do that, you might want to act quickly. I'm going to be doing some. I'm thinking ribs and chicken and maybe pork loin for that. Yeah. I'm really looking forward to it. It's been kind of gray today. Yesterday there was enough sun to burn my pink little head, and today it started out sunny and then got cloudy, but the one constant seems to be that about every minute and a half, there's a plane taking off from Washington National Airport, which I refuse to refer to by the name of that greasy-headed old B-movie actor, you know, old 666 himself, Ronald Wilson Reagan. And that's, I can handle some city living for a little bit, but then I'm ready to get back to the hills. We hillbillies, we pine. Yeah. Hey, Bo. I got a mic set up for Bo and some, and a set of headphones and everything. So, because it's a big deal. Tomorrow, 7 years, almost 7 years exactly after we put this bill together and got it introduced back in 2012, tomorrow the bill is the AIC Act, the Appalachian Communities Health Emergency Act, is going to be reintroduced in this Congress, and it's the first time that we've ever had a friendly Congress to take up the bill. And then a week from today, another historic first, there will be a hearing in the House Natural Resources Committee headed by Representative Raul Grijalva of Arizona, health impacts of mountaintop removal on the people who, not the people who work there, but the people who have to, who just live nearby and have to deal with it on a daily basis. So we're really excited about it. And I think it's got a good chance of making some real progress in the House. Now the Senate's another matter, but you know what? We'll do this in the House, and then we'll worry about the Senate in 2020. Because remember, we're daring to dream in 2020, not just getting a majority, but running a whole bunch of these godforsaken Republicans right out of office and letting them retire. You know, you walk by some of these offices in these buildings, and it immediately brings out the Yosemite Sam in me. You'll see a name that you recognize, and I think Bo earlier today even saw the creepy wrestler, you know, Jim Shorts Jordan, the guy who looked the other way at little boys getting raped and now has the nerve to lecture anybody about anything. And by the way, thank you. Bill in Allentown tells me the new gizmo sounds like you're in the same room. Well, I am in the same room. So we're checking Bo's cans. So he's got, and now let's check Bo's mic. Bo Webb, speak up.
Oh, hi, Bob.
Hi, Bo.
I'm here.
Yeah, and you do sound good.
Okay, good.
So, I mean, all kidding aside, I know we're sort of tooting our own horn, but nobody knows more about this bill than us two, do they?
I don't think so. Not even the sponsor doesn't know as much about it as we do.
Yeah, and that's not taking anything away, but it's not a big bill. It's not a 500-page doorstop or anything. But we've had some success these couple of days, haven't we?
We certainly have. We've been well received in all of the offices we have visited and met with. And we even had a couple of offices immediately say they were going to sign on as co-sponsors at the introduction tomorrow. And other ones that promised to take it to their boss, and they expect their boss to sign on as a co-sponsor. I don't think we had any negative meetings at all.
Yeah, I haven't had any, no. Of course, we're not meeting with Republicans, so, I mean, just kind of have not to yet. Deal with that. Do you think we can give out any detail about?
It's posted now, so I mean the.
Well, I mean, I know there's one particular individual signing onto this bill that will be very, very exciting to the progressive community and the Horn family community.
Well, they already signed in. Yarmouth's office sent me her name this morning at 9 o'clock. She already contacted them. She's on the bill. So
and sure by she means. And by she we mean Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. It was almost like a no-brainer.
Yeah, we had sent her her office a meeting request, and yesterday morning we got a reply that you don't need to meet with us. We're on the bill. So that was great.
And I think we've had some members of the community. I know of at least a couple from her district who have reached out to let them know that we're up here and the bill is coming. I want to thank our buddy Mike in Cascadia for reaching out to his member of the House. We're in the process of requesting, I've requested a meeting with them. Jim in Spain has reached out to his member, and we're asking, and so we're all kind of in this together. And that's the way this process works best, because when you reach out to your member of the House, then we in turn have the doors cracked open for us, right?
It makes it much easier for us to send an email for a meeting request, and we can mention that person's name, the constituent's name, and that gets us in much easier than just a cold request.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and by the way, we have focused because, we've talked to a lot of people over the years. Some are, have been defeated. Some retired. Some have sadly passed away. So our focus this week has been this really, really big freshman class who were, they were the blue wave of 2018. And there really was one. It's, I don't know about you, Bo, but it's been kind of neat because I keep walking past these names and I'll check them out when I see the plaque on the door. It's like, son of a gun, that's a new Democrat.
Yeah. And the part I've enjoyed about these meetings also, the ones that I've had and ones we've had together even, is that the legislative assistant or director, whoever we happen to meet with, they're genuinely pleased that we contacted them and that we're in their office meeting with them. That's kind of the reverse of the way it has been. You used to get kind of a feeling like they might just be feeling an obligation sometimes. Some meetings you'd have someone rolling a pencil on the table and, having something else in mind.
I've had legislative assistants, we won't say who they worked for, play with their hair. In a meeting. And I don't think it's because we didn't bring our A game. Because we go into these meetings pretty fired up, don't we?
Yes, and the amazing difference about going in the U.S. House of Representatives now as compared for the past 6 years is that people have their heads held up high as previously their heads were hanging low. They couldn't get anything accomplished. They were down and dejected. And there was no energy in those offices. And you notice a huge difference now, don't you, Bob?
Oh, they're energized, they're excited, and especially since we've been dealing with these freshman offices, they have the idealism of being new to the process. And I think that's really important.
That's right. And even in the House Natural Resources Committee, where our bill will land at tomorrow, we had a meeting there today, and they were pumped up. You could tell, and they've been doing this a long time. and so we could tell them about the hearing, right?
Oh, yeah.
Next Tuesday at 2 p.m., the House Natural Resources is holding a hearing on mountaintop removal and human health. And in the hearing, Mr. Yarmouth, John Yarmouth from Kentucky, the sponsor of our bill, will make an appearance and talk about how the AIC Act addresses the health issues associated with mountaintop removal in those communities. So it's going to give our bill a huge boost. We've never gotten the bill before committee in a hearing. We've done numerous briefings, but we never got a hearing until now. So we're charged. The committee seems to be the Democratic the side of the committee. They seem to be charged and ready to do some good things with the bill.
I think so. And I mean, this is you can't overstate the importance of this forum. Because this is an opportunity. This is the government paying attention to the suffering of a marginalized community.
Correct.
And that's what Democrats do. It's not what the other side does. You know, as an aside, by the way, and I know you because we've talked about it together. It may scare the Republicans right out of their pants. But I have seen something that I find extremely inspiring in these last couple of days that I have in 10 years of working in this town off and on, I've never seen before. And I know you know what I'm talking about. We have seen more women.
That's absolutely
in hijabs. In the halls of these House office buildings than we have ever seen before.
And, all ages, too, by the way.
Yeah. And just to be clear, I don't have to agree with a religious view or a faith view or anything like that to be able to say that it is a good thing for America when more Americans are participating in the American experiment.
Exactly. Yeah, there is a change taking place in the U.S. House of Representatives that we haven't seen in a long, long time. And it's a change for the good. And I'm really excited about it. We've been beating these streets for a long time. And huge encouragement. And we should say something about our star witness that was not next Tuesday. We have a great scientist that's going to testify about the health effects of mountaintop removal in these communities with impeccable credentials. Dr. Michael McCauley from West Virginia University, he was the head of the CDC's air quality division for a number of years. This man he's groundbreaking work in ultrafine particles that Europe has done a lot of work on, and yet the USA has more or less ignored it at the EPA. They don't even go down. Ultrafine particles are super, super small particles.
And super poisonous. In fact,
exactly.
I've talked about it. I've talked about these ultrafines on this program a lot, and everything that I know about it and that you know about it has come from Dr. McCauley.
Exactly.
He even went so far as to traveling to Wisconsin with me once upon a time to warn folks up there about what was being done to them with the blasting of the sand hills. Because the whole point with all of this is that it's, you know, we don't have these health crises in West Virginia because of coal itself. We have it because of what's on top of the coal.
Exactly.
That gets, you know, turned into these tiny, tiny particles of dust. And the same thing happens anytime you blast like that into rock formations anywhere.
Another point to that blasting is that at my home in West Virginia, they're blasting away 2,100 acres above me. They've been doing this for a number of years. They're actually about finished with that permit, so we're looking for them to expand it or, you know, get a revision to make it larger, of course, but maybe even move it closer to homes, which are on top of us now. But we get a variety of colors of dust that settles on our deck and the house. Sometimes it's yellow. Sometimes it's like a, an olive green. It can be a black. It can be a brown. It can be sometimes it can have like a film oily substance to it. And I was talking with Dr. Michael Hendricks. He was at my house. I'm showing him some of that and told him about the different makeups of it depending on what day they blasted. And what he told me made a lot of sense. He goes, well, you know, when you're blasting away 600, 700, 800 feet of a mountain, you are unearthing things that have been buried for millions and millions and millions of years. He says, so you hit different depths of the strata, and you don't know what you're releasing, really. And that, to me, that really got my attention. It was kind of a scary thought when I started thinking about that. And I asked him, I said, do you think there could be, you know, living organics or something that could get... He goes, well, I don't know about that. He says, but... We don't really know what's been released. We know that silica and aluminum and molybdenum metals are being released. They've identified those under microscope.
And we've gotten to learn some really big words in the last several years, like polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons.
Yeah, I lost track of how to say that. I haven't said it for so long. I would just blotch that all up.
Tell
PCBs.
PAHs.
PAH, yeah. See?
Tell folks about your apple tree.
Oh, that was interesting. My apple trees, I went to get some out. They were growing so nice, and I was over and I was cutting grass around the trees, and it was coming time we could start picking some apples.
And those are old timey West Virginia Appalachian
super sweet green.
Yeah, but they're green and they have like they're speckled.
Well, these were more than speckled.
Well, no, but I mean they're kind of speckly in their natural state.
Yeah. Well, these had dark spots all over them that just was strange. And I pulled some of them from the tree and I took them to the house and I washed them off and I bit into one and it was delicious. And I went, "Oh man, and my wife goes, "Well, what's all that black stuff in there?" I go, "I don't know." And I started rubbing it and you could actually smear it. It would smear. And so the United States Geological Survey scientists came in. That they were already interested in what was going on there, and they had collected dust. I'd taken them around for 2 years, actually, getting dust. And I showed them my apples, and they tucked some of the apples back here to Reston, Virginia, near D.C. with them. And their toxicologist called me about a month later, and she says, "Hey," she says, "don't eat those apples. They are contaminated. They're toxic." And I went, "Wow." I said, "I haven't eaten any of them. I was waiting to see." And she said, "I wouldn't eat them." She says, "We can't identify the toxins, but the test we do shows that they are toxic. There's something on those." And that was about the same time that they had also taken soil from my garden. And then they told me, "Don't eat any." The way they said is, "If I were you, I wouldn't eat anything out of that garden. The toxins are in your soil. We can't say 100% certain they're in your vegetables, but we know they're in the soil. So, you know, your air is contaminated, your water is contaminated, and your soil is contaminated." And a sad note to this is I'm going down the road that very same day that I learned this, and my neighbor, who I like very much, she was in her little garden tending her corn, and she was telling me that her corn wasn't growing very well. And I told her about what we had heard. I says, "You know, she's got apple trees. She's got pear trees. Don't eat any of those pears or apples. We always ate those." I says, "But I'm just telling you, I was told by USGS not to eat anything that's growing in this ground." And I was headed to D.C., actually, and I was gone for 2 weeks on that trip. And when I came home, she was in the hospital, and she died. She had a tumor that she didn't know she had. And when she learned that she had it, it was too late. And it was in her stomach. And it had grown to the point where it had pressed against her intestines and everything, and she had a crisis. And I guess they went to do surgery, and she didn't make it. And she was probably 60 years old, but nice lady. And I've told some other folks about don't eat out of your garden. Don't even grow a garden. Don't eat your apples. And they do anyway.
Well, I think it's hard for people to, and that's part of the reason that we use this one line, what you can't see can kill you. People have a hard time conceiving that that this is part of their reality. And, I mean, this lady that you're describing, of course, our dear friend, our leader, our mentor, Judy Bonds.
Yeah. Cancer.
Your beloved wife.
My wife. The little boy across the river from me. The guy right up the hill from me. To my little road that comes to my house, three people in that road have passed away now with cancer in the last 3 years. That's just there's eight houses on my road. Dead people and three of them from cancer. And the oldest one was my wife. She was 70. But she was a picture of health.
Yeah.
And hers came sudden, just like my neighbor Ruth. Hers came sudden. Judy's. Bob and I were with Judy. We were all together at a dig in Nashville where Music Saves Mountains.
Music Saves Mountains, right.
And then Judy was going to go to California to meet some groups there. You know, we're looking for foundation money, and she was going from there. And we drove to Nashville, the three of us together, and Judy was going to fly out from Nashville. And the day before, she was saying she wasn't feeling well, and then she called and she asked me if I would bring her some breakfast. She didn't think she could go down to the restaurant. Her leg was hurting. So I took her some breakfast, and Bob and I left. And then she called a few days later and asked me to pick her up at the airport, about 2 days later, coming back. And when I picked her up at Charleston Airport, she was hurting. And she went to call the doctor the next day. She went in. She had a spot on her. They found a blood clot in her leg that was headed to her lung. And so consequently from that, they took a lot of lung x-rays, and bingo, there was a tumor in her lung. And that was in June or July of 2010, and January the 3rd.
She was gone.
2011, she was gone. And she suffered. She went through some rough times there. And there was Judy. Non-smoker, organic food. Her mistake was she lived in a mountaintop removal community. That was her problem. So we lost her.
I'm going to ask for the sake of folks listening, because you and I obviously have a lot of conversations. How do you deal with the pain and the anger?
You're asking me?
I'm asking you.
Well, I think, as you know, I had a pretty rough time there for a while.
Yeah.
But I decided that I needed to work harder. And if I was going to do my wife, Joanne, and Judy Bonds justice, then I needed to work harder and focus. Put my focus on the work and not so much focus on anger. I will admit that I had a lot of pretty bad things went through my head. I even, I considered bad things to do to the coal industry and the bosses that ran that mountaintop removal site above my home. And I got to the point where, well, I didn't want to be there anymore. And I actually have left West Virginia, as Bob knows. And I'm a refugee, kind of.
that's an appropriate term.
Yeah. It's just too dangerous to be there. And so I left, and I'm living in a little town in Massachusetts that I'm loving, and the Appalachian Mountains are right there. I can enjoy those. I can go to Vermont, and I'm close to the ocean too, so I can enjoy all that. And I found that kind of peaceful setting with a real democracy, Massachusetts has a real democracy, so unlike West Virginia, I found some peace there and able to, get back into this work with everything and just continue the fight.
But there's no doubt these coal industry executives, they know what they're doing, don't they?
They absolutely know they're killing people, and they continue to kill people. And that's the part that really drives me, is sociopaths have been in control of our country for a long time. And when you blow up mountains directly over top of people's homes, and you're going to try to tell us no one's being harmed from that, we know two things. We know that you're a liar, and we know that you're a sociopath. And some of them are psychopaths. It just is so wrong. You know, the science is there. They refuse to be educated on the science. You know, it's like stick your not even
instead
stick your
head they
in the
spent
stand, they fight it.
Instead, they spent $10 million to trying to buy themselves some pet scientists
right.
who would refute the findings of the peer-reviewed science that we have.
Right.
And yet, for all their $10 million, they couldn't do it.
Exactly. And here's a really, if they were serious about learning the science and what was really happening there, they would have taken that $10 million and bought an independent health study. There's a big difference between a health study and health research. Research is just that. A health study is where they get into families, the history. They will track down and name the causation, the way it's delivered, the whole bit. And they paid these fake scientists guy at Virginia Tech $10 million to head up this goofy thing and wasted $10 million when they could have got a health study for less than $8 million. Columbia University did a study on the AIC Act, on the Appalachian Communities Health Emergency Act. I didn't even know they were doing it until it was over, and they published, it's on YouTube, you can look it up. They speak of it about on there, and they give a presentation. The AIC Act health study would cost about $8 million, and it would take 5 years. So they did a complete analysis of it. They spoke very well of the AIC Act, as most scientists, I think, have, except for those that's hired by the coal industry.
Indeed. So when obviously we're asking for help from people all over the country to reach out to their members of the House. Talk a little bit about why all the focus on the House and we haven't said anything about the Senate.
Right. Well, we took a good year away from the House. Well, we still called on the House, so we never stopped calling on the House, but we focused on the Senate for about a year, year and a half. And we met with Republicans and Democrats. And I do believe that we had a friend in the Senate that would have introduced this bill over there, a version of it, if he had lived, and that's John McCain. He had stated that if he became president, he would end mountaintop removal. And we called on his office. We had good meetings, but this wasn't when he was already sick, actually, when we met with him. But our champion over there on the Republican side was Lamar Alexander from Tennessee. He deplores mountaintop removal. He despises mountaintop removal. And he has looked to do something about it for a long time. And he even got a Democratic partner, Senator Ben Cardin from Maryland, and Senator Alexander. They did introduce a bill called the Appalachian Restoration Act, probably in 2006, somewhere in there. And when it went into committee for markup, it just got shredded, and it became very ineffective, and it died. So we got his interest in the AIC Act, and they were looking at that. And for 1 year, we met with that office and Ben Cardin's office, and those two offices were having conference calls and meeting with each other and discussing ways and how this bill would look in the Senate, and everything was going real smooth, and we thought for sure it's going to happen. We'll have one Democrat, one Republican, a bipartisan bill introduced in the Senate here pretty soon. And Alexander backed off. And we later learned that the reason he backed off was because he did not have Mitch McConnell's blessing on the bill.
Permission.
He didn't have his permission. Exactly. And if he would have introduced the bill, he would have been in hot water with McConnell. Any bill that Alexander may have brought up to benefit his constituents in Tennessee, McConnell would have sat on. So he made a decision to just leave it alone, and there went that. That's why we spent so much time in the Senate, and that's why we're not going over there right now. It's too unfavorable. We have made a lot of calls on Senate offices, and I think out of 38 Senate offices we visited, 32 of them told us they would vote on a bill like this. They did not want to introduce it. Some of them would say, well, don't you think Senator Manchin would introduce that? I almost want to laugh.
And some of those, you almost want to kick the furniture, the table leg of it. Yeah, because, well.
Joe Manchin is not going to introduce the bill, and no one in West Virginia is going to support the bill, because no politician, because they're solely owned by the coal industry. People don't know this outside of West Virginia, but in West Virginia, if you are going to run for political office and you stand up to do a stump speech, the first words that come out of your mouth better be, "Hello, my name is Joe Manchin, and I'm a friend of coal." He does it every time. They all do it. If they don't do that, they're not going to be elected. It's really that simple.
It's embarrassing, and it's infuriating, because the people who are dying in West Virginia are no less constituents of Joe Manchin's than the coal. Well, I guess
the coal industry is not constituents. Most of them live somewhere else. The money, yeah. They blow up the mountains, take the money, and they're out of there. They're not there. A lot of this wealth is distributed on Wall Street.
International banks like Deutsche Bank and Commerzbank in Germany, Credit Agricole in France. I mean, the entire European financial system at one point in time, it seems, has dumped money into mountaintop removal because, and this is the reason for it, you have very low labor costs. You have to spend money on expensive Caterpillar machinery.
That you get tax credits for.
That you get tax credits for.
You have to depreciation.
So the banks that do the debt, they get their VIG. The bond issues, there's money in the front end of that. And then by the time you've gotten all the coal out of it, what?
The bond issue is an issue because the state of West Virginia now allows the coal companies to bond themselves.
Well, that's a different kind of bonding, but yeah.
Well, I'm talking about those bonds that they used to have to get was to repair the damage that they would do if they went bankrupt.
Yeah, that's the reclamation bonds.
Right. And what they've done now, self-bonding, what they have done, they wind the company down when they're done with a mountaintop removal. They create a new company for a mountaintop removal operation. As they're going along, they take the money from that operation. Here they get to ending the mining. They take that money and they put it into another operation, another whole entity. And they drain it, they break it, they bankrupt it, they file Chapter 11 or 13, they're out of it, they're gone, and there sits this mess that no one is going to be cleaning up except for citizens.
And, you know, that should be part, you know, we've talked a lot about the Green New Deal. And when it comes, the other thing we've talked about for years and years and years is the need for an Appalachian Marshall Plan. Because none of these mines, with the possible, none of these sites, they're not even mines, they're sites.
Sore sites.
Yeah. None of them are ever so-called reclaimed within the actual meaning of the law. You know, there's one Potemkin village sort of, that where, you know, Hobet, what is it, Hobet number?
21.
Yeah, Hobet 21, where they take the, and, oh, look, you know, hey, look, there's a turkey. Look, a deer. You know, cue the deer. And
it's their show site.
Yeah.
They did put some money in reclaiming that. They brought in topsoil. They planted grass. They planted trees. They put a pond in, and it's about, I think it's all of about 10 acres out of maybe 5,000. And then when the politician comes to West Virginia and they want to take them around to show them a mountaintop removal site, that's what they take them to. This is a reclaimed site. This is what we do. They put a golf course on one of them, Twisted Gun or something like that's the name of it, and they put some ATV trails on another one. So that's three that I know that had some reclamation on out of 500. And the rest of them look like moonscape or some of the shots you see of Mars. That's what this stuff looks like when they get finished. It's rock. There is no topsoil. That's all been dumped down and covered up a living stream.
And there's no forest. There's nothing. Scrub pines, scrub brush, and nothing can be done with these sites.
They tried for a while. They did this on Kayford Mountain. They brought in the Surface Mine Control Reclamation Act allows them to use topsoil substitute. So they've got all of this topsoil.
Wait. So this is what, a product? I can't believe it's not topsoil?
Yes. They got this from China. So we're going back maybe 20 years ago. And they brought it to Kayford Mountain, Larry Gibson's area up there. And they put it down and they planted these pine trees. And 5 years later, those pine trees had not grown. Some of them had washed away because the topsoil would not adhere to the rocks, so rain would wash it away. And the last time I was up there was maybe 5 years ago, and those pines, what were left of them, they were green. I'll give them that. They were green, but they were not as tall as me.
They were Charlie Brown's Christmas tree.
Exactly. There you go.
Yeah. And so, I mean, this is the reality here. You know, when we go through these offices, it's almost like a litany with the statistics and the realities that we describe. And some of these people have never heard of it before, and they get shocked and they get angry.
Some people think we must be making up a story. Yeah. You start describing mountaintop removal, and we have to tell them this is real, you know. And you can guide them to a Google map, and they can zoom in and look at it.
And I mean, anybody can go to Google Earth, and if you just, you know, when you get down to like where your screen is nothing but West Virginia, you'll see that it has spots on it all over southern West Virginia, like, I don't know,
grayish brown spots.
Yeah, like some sort of, you know, flea bites or something.
Yeah, and none of the other states have that.
You know. And then as you drill down, what you realize you're looking at are these vast complexes of just ruined land.
Yeah, mountains.
And then if you start looking around those complexes, see houses.
Yeah, you see the sludge dams.
And sludge dams and valley fills. But it's houses where people live. And that's where the disease processes come from. Because if you work on it, and one of the weird things is black lung's on the rise among coal workers.
Strip miners.
And it's on the rise in its most virulent form among these people who work on these sites. You know, maybe because they're all macho and don't want to wear their respirators or whatever. But the bottom line is, it's on the rise among them, and they get to go home every day.
Yeah, and you know, here's the thing.
What if you have to live there 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year?
You're breathing it.
And this is more than two decades now.
One thing, just to add on to what Bob is talking about, these strip miners, most of them are not local people. They're hired. They may live 50, 60 miles away. and where there is no mountaintop removal, because they're heavy equipment operators. They're not coal miners. The coal miners that were there were underground coal miners who are now dying of black lung or sitting in their house trying to make it from their retirement check to retirement check or whatever aid they can get. There are no jobs. They want everyone gone. They want everyone to move, and then they can do what they want. But some of those folks are just not going to move. They love their mountains, and they love where they lived. They won't oppose the coal company, but they won't leave. But these guys will go home in the evening. They throw their beer cans and their garbage out as they go up the road. And that is for the purpose of depressing the local people and making the place ugly. They even the government of West Virginia even changed the flood zone and moved it further closer to homes along the Coal River and put an ordinance in that if your home is flooded out, you cannot rebuild. You cannot rebuild on that land where you were. You cannot do that, no matter what insurance you have or anything else. Discourages people to live there. That's another one of their tactics.
So they get to go home, but people who breathe this stuff, and what was one of those studies, when they simulated the dose and the duration, It was about 8.5 years until you could expect to see the mutagenic changes that become cancer start to happen.
Another thing about with those guys going home in the evening, as Bob was saying, they are issued breathing mask to wear to protect them from the dust that generated on those MTR sites. That dust on the MTR sites settles in the communities. The guys on that strip site, they have protection with the respirators that they wear. They have protection from OSHA. And in some cases, they have protection from United Mine Workers Union. Some of them, not all of them. And the citizens that live there that are breathing this stuff 24 hours a day, 365 days a year, are issued nothing. And that includes babies and kids and dogs and cats.
And the other thing is, and we talked about the size of these particles. One of the things is up above these ridges, before they blow them up, you've got industrial scale wind speeds.
Yep.
And so when that blasting dust gets launched into the air from the explosive charge, those particulates can go for miles and miles and miles. People who never even had heard the blast can be breathing the particulate matter.
We don't know how far out the danger area is. One of the next things that we're going to be that was going to be done was research on that very concern, and that was the United States Geological Survey was doing it, and we did dust samples with those guys, those scientists and women, men and women, for 2 years. And in different communities, we went out as far as 2 miles from a mountaintop removal site and didn't note any difference in the concentrations. But they were going to expand to see how far it went out. And suddenly when they identified the dust, they identified the source of the dust, and they did that by observing it for 2 years. And they saw that we can look at blasting records, the blasting logs of these coal mines. You can demand it, and you can look at those at the West Virginia Department of Environmental Protection. So we looked at those, and you can see when the mining activity was heavy, the concentrations of the particulates were greater. When the mining activity was down, the concentrations were down. When the coal company closed down for 2 weeks vacation in the summer, the particles disappeared. When they come back, they start back up. So USGS surmised that this is the source. The crustal elements that we're looking at under a microscope are the same ID as the ones on the mountaintop removal site itself. So they identified it. They identified what was in it, these cancer-causing elements, silica mostly, and aluminum, like I was saying. And within 2 weeks of them talking about that, and Bob and I here in D.C. educating some congressional offices about it, and I had a meeting with Joe Manchin, Senator Manchin, and I told him that this report was coming out and that he should get ahead of the game, and he really should introduce the ache and address that health concern. They suddenly got stripped, denied any funding for mountaintop removal and human health. They were told that you're no longer going to work on mountaintop removal and human health. We're going to put you over on fracking. And they ran, gave the scientists a runaround. The toxicologist lost her job. She was outspoken.
And the USGS has never been seen in the Coal River Valley since.
Not since. Nothing. And those were some great scientists that were working on
it. Well, I've got a story. I just saw this thing, and this is going to make you bark. This is going to make you pissed. Because when I was talking about the people who have worked on this issue and poured their very lives into this issue, and that and talking in Congress in particular, you know, some people win lose elections, some people retire, and some people die. And one of those was a dear friend to this cause, and that's Louise Slaughter. Mm-hmm. She was the oldest serving member of Congress when she passed away at the age of 88. And she was a pack of dynamite. And she was from Harlan County, Kentucky, and even though she'd lived in upstate New York for decades, she still sounded like a Harlan County, Kentucky girl.
And she was a scientist also.
Yeah, she was an epidemiologist,
yes.
Wasn't she?
Yes.
Yeah. And she took this issue very seriously. Well, so Nancy Pelosi spoke at her funeral. And spoke highly of her.
Well, she actually, Louise Slaughter had an office in the Capitol.
Yeah.
She had her office in one of the House buildings also, but she had an office over there. She is as a senior member and whatever she was attached to. She got to have this big office over there. I was fortunate enough to meet her personally the first time by another great heroine of ours, Joan Mulhern from Earth Justice. She's passed away now, but she took me to Louise Slaughter's office and introduced me to Louise, and Louise knew all about mountaintop removal, and I'll never forget, she took my hand and she goes, "Are you ready to do this for the next 12 years? I said, "Yeah." She says, "Okay, we'll get it passed." She says, "It's going to take 8 to 12 years, but we'll get it done." And she told me about her previous work of bills to do with public health from toxins, and it took her 12 years to get a bill.
Well, did you know that she was the original sponsor of the first Violence Against Women Act?
I didn't know that.
I mean, she made good use of her time. So here's the part where you're going to get pissed off. She served for 30 years in the Congress.
Right.
And you know, that's called serving your country. And she made positive impacts. She didn't just draw her breath in her pay. So a bipartisan group got together and thought, you know what? It would be a fitting tribute to name a post office after Louise Slaughter. Do you know that there were seven Republicans in the House who were such shitbirds that they voted against that?
Who were they?
Representative Bill Flores of Texas. And one of the most idiotic, dumb, that makes Donald Trump look like Albert freaking Einstein, Glenn Grothman of Wisconsin, Andy Harris of Maryland, Thomas Massey of Kentucky, Tom Rice of South Carolina, David Rouser of North Carolina, and Chip Roy, who is kind of, he's kind of entered my consciousness during a hearing a couple of weeks back, because he, when it came time for him to talk, he talked about, I sure do wish I was back home in Dribbling Dick, Texas, where I did, or what, I mean, it was some sort of stupid.
Are you telling me that even Jim Jordan and Bill
apparently
Johnson,
Jim Shorts Jordan got it right.
And Bill Johnson.
And Louis wow. Asparagus Gohmert and Steve Cantaloupe's Nazi King.
Well, they say they had a little respect for her.
Yeah, but those seven, yeah, no, you know.
Well, it didn't work but for them. But
it was 414 members of Congress, 231 Democrats, and 183 Republicans. But those seven shit-eaters,
wow.
Just no. I don't know, I guess because...
She probably stung him on something somewhere.
Right. Probably, it was probably one of those situations where she explained to them exactly what they were worth and mm-hmm. and where to get off.
She was an eloquent speaker, and she could burn someone with a smile on her face.
Yeah, to ash. Yeah. Oh, that was the question out of the chat room. No, we're talking about Louise Slaughter. And Louise was side-by-side with John Yarmuth, an original co-sponsor of the Eighth Act, every year that she was there.
And at every one of our briefings, mm-hmm. she would come and speak.
Exactly. So I got a note here from Scott in San Diego, Bo. Has 60 Minutes ever done a story on this issue? No. CNN tried to tackle it once, but they both cidered it so badly that it was just a hot mess. And Scott then asks, how many states does mountaintop removal happen in? I know that West Virginia is not the only coal-producing state. Surely there must be others, and if there are, the number of people whose health is being put at risk must number in the low millions.
It does. Four states, West Virginia. And West Virginia has more mountaintop removal coal mine than any other state. The other three states are Kentucky. That's the eastern end of Kentucky. The little tiny northeast corner of Tennessee and southwest Virginia. And in southwest Virginia, in Wise County, 25% of the land in Wise County, Virginia, has been destroyed by.
I think that number is actually higher now.
It's probably. I'm going by an old number. It could be 30-35%. Dr. Hendricks did research in Wise County using the model that we developed in the Coal River Valley. I was part of that study, and we had an IRB from WVU on that. And Dr. Hendricks took that same protocol and applied it in Virginia and. The results of our results of cancer was the mountaintop removal community where I live has nearly double the cancer rates of the non-mountaintop removal communities in West Virginia. Wise County was more than double and found similar findings in Kentucky also. I don't believe any work's been done in Tennessee, but again, that's like Campbell County. Northeast corner of Tennessee, there's some mountaintop removal that they call it Cross Ridge mining. They came up with a fancy name for it there, but that's what it is. That's the four states. It's not conducted in anywhere else. And it's defined by the Surface Mine Control Reclamation Act. It defines mountaintop removal as surface mining on the steep slope ridges of Appalachia on mountains of 20% grade or more. And so you're every mountain, you know, is a candidate for mountaintop removal.
If it's got coal in it,
oh yeah.
They want to blow it up. So the bill drops tomorrow. Do we have any idea what time?
Soon as Mr. Yarmuth goes over to the Capitol, he will drop it. That's what Katie says. It'll probably be early. And she's going to email us and give us the bill number. We won't get a bill number till it's dropped. And it'll get assigned a bill number, and then we'll have it.
Okay. And once we do that, we can start. We can start really reaching out and say, call your representative, tell exactly. them, this is the bill number, right?
Yes. And we have I always put it up all the time, but even on our website is old. We don't have a web designer, but you can still go to the AICAC.org website, and you can easily find your congressional representatives simply by putting in your zip code, and you'll get their contact information. It'll pop up. You'll get their contact information, and their addresses, their phone numbers, their emails, everything.
Well, we are far from done, because there's more progress to be made in this Congress than in all of the previous ones we've worked in combined.
Yeah, and we do feel that we have a chance of getting it passed through the House this year. But we are not so naive that we don't know what will happen to it when it goes to the Senate. McConnell will simply sit on it. But we continue to work to set the table, get it through the House, get rid of McConnell in 2020, and then, it's ready to be passed in the Senate. And then hopefully we will have a president with a conscience in 2020, and the president will sign it. And that will basically be the end of mountaintop removal. They will not, it will,
now by the,
it will wind down.
By the way, the way the bill operates, though, there will be a waiting period in order for the study to be done so that we can come up with the final answers.
No, the bill actually puts an end immediately once it's signed into law to any new
permits.
Well, wait, though. Any, it puts an end to any new permits, and it puts you cannot get an expansion or a revision on a current permit. So we had to do it that way because the coal industry has investment in these sites, so we got to be realistic. We're not going to be able to take a permit away that they have invested money in and they already have a permit. We're not going to be able to do that. And they will start claiming, you're taking all these jobs. We have our money. I don't think the House would even pass a bill like that. You're just talking huge, huge problems with it.
But in terms of affecting an absolute abolition of the process, the study has to be done, and then the certification has to be written by the Secretary of DHHR.
Right. What would happen is no new permits would be issued. They would work their current permits, and right along, as that's going on, there would be a health study conducted by the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences, and they would be about 5 years for the study. So a lot of those permits are only good for 3 years. By the end of the 5 years, there are no more permits, basically, Bob.
Right.
They wouldn't be able to renew them. So it would be over in 3 years with the working permits, and there would be no new permits. And at the end of the health study, there would never be another permit allowed unless the Secretary of Health declared that mountaintop removal is not a danger to people's health.
And that's impossible because they can't keep their dust on their site. It's like what the West Virginia Department of Environmental Polluting said. Once the dust leaves the site, it's not their responsibility.
Exactly. Yeah. But, you see how that actually it would be over in 3 years because there would be no renewal of permits. So it would be done. And it would take 2 more years for the study that there wouldn't be any mountaintop removal, and then there would never be any more unless.
And Parson Brown asks in the chat room, is this the only bill addressing MTR that's on the roster at the moment?
Yes. It's the only bill that's ever been introduced in Congress that will actually end mountaintop removal. There was a previous bill, and I'm not a bashful about talking about it. It's called the Clean Water Protection Act, and it was introduced in the 2005, somewhere in there, maybe even a little bit before that. And I jumped all over that and to help them with that bill, and I traveled to North Carolina and helped them raise funds for the bill.
Oh.
I came to D.C. I said what they wanted me to say, and all of
Agnes,
that.
Agnes and I went.
Yeah,
our children
all
went.
All of us. A lot of people in the Coal River Valley went and spoke about this bill and knocked on doors and stayed in cheap hotels with four people in a room. It's just pretty disgusting stuff.
It's a sore spot.
And started looking at the bill. I never had really looked at the bill. And looked at the bill one day, and our Vernon Halton, he goes, "This would never end mountaintop removal." And the bill was real simple. It was just to restore the Clean Water Act. And what had happened, it was all about valley fills. It basically would prevent any new valley fills. Well, the coal industry got around that. They saw that that might happen. They didn't have to create new valley fills. They created this new stuff, this new way of getting rid of the mountain's waste. They call it backstacking. So what they would do, they would blast, remove all of the overburden, the rock, the dirt, and everything off the coal, put it behind them, and then get the coal, then go the next blast, do the same thing, backstack, put it behind you. You don't got to throw it over the mountain. And they did that with drag lines and whatnot. So I approached these folks and told them, I said, "It looks to me like your bill will never end mountaintop removal." And they go, "Well, yeah, you're right. It won't." And we sat and work, because I told them they're doing backstacking. "Yeah, we know, and we worry about that all the time." I go, "Well, it seems to me that you probably should trash can that bill. You're wasting money on it. We're beating our feet in D.C. for you on it, and it's never going to end mountaintop removal." And they said they didn't really know what to do. And I talked with them about it. I says, "Why don't you draft a bill that prevents them from blasting if they can't blast?" Oh no, we could never do that. And I decided at that moment, I was in D.C. with them, and I decided, I'm out of here, and I'm going
home. Not
going to
play this game anymore.
And we're going to devise something. I called Bob. We got a little team of locals together, and we came together, and we...
This actually started...
So this is it.
The day that Appalachia Rising ended, we were staying in a flea bag out in Manassas.
Yeah, when we left, and I was sick, running a fever from all that work, and we started talking about it. I said, "You know, we got to do something," and we
Parson Brown remembers the
That's
Clean Water Protection Act. He said, "I'm aware. I worked on it for 10 years."
Yep, and we were duped. To be quite frank about it, we were duped into believing this would end our misery, and we were duped by an organization that doesn't have one person on their staff that lives anywhere near mountaintop removal, from a state that does not have mountaintop removal, that state that does not even have coal mining, and they pretend to this day to be the voices of Appalachia.
Yeah, that's
infuriating.
That's one of the things that hangs in your craw. I'll tell you what, this has been a great conversation, Bo. We will, if people want to follow you on Facebook, and, you know, you'll be putting up the bill, I'll be putting up the bill. It'll go up at the Appalachian Communities Health Emergency Facebook page. It'll go up at the Coal River Mountain Watch page. And I guess that's the one thing that I want to close this conversation on. This truly is what it means to do grassroots organizing work. Because, you know, we did beg for relief. We begged the smart people. We begged the people with the multi-million dollar budgets. We begged the people who told us they were ever so much smarter than us dumb hillbillies. And every time we begged, they would, because I had those conversations too. I remember one of them in Lynch, Kentucky. Mm-hmm. And I was told, "Well, you know, we just don't think that we're ever going to, that's probably not the thing we want to do, is having a mountaintop removal abolition bill, Bob." Yeah. And I got furious. And that's where the idea came from, that if this is going to get done, the people it's being done to are going to be have to be the people who get the job done. And so make no mistake, please. Going forward, if you hear someone else talking about the AIC Act and trying to take ownership of it, you need to know you're being led on.
We think that could very well happen here in the near future.
Yeah. If it's not Coal River Mountain Watch, if it's not the AIC campaign, if it's not Bo Webb, me, a small handful of other people, you're being shaded. If somebody says that they have a bill or something, because they don't, and that's just a word to the wise. So yeah,
and for correct history's sake, Bob and I, and Joan Mulhern of Earth Justice, drafted the bill.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember the day.
February 2012.
Exactly. Because I thought Joan was going to pass out when I told her, I got the meeting. We're going to get the bill. Remember how excited she was?
Yeah. I called her and I go, "We don't know how to write a bill." She goes, "Come on over and we'll write it."
Yep. Exactly. Well, both, it's
all right, it was good.
It's not like you're going anywhere. I mean, we're staying here together, but yeah,
I get my private time now, though. So.
Exactly. Exactly. Bo Webb, thanks a ton, brother.
Sure. Thank you, Bob.
That's my buddy and my colleague, Bo Webb, and I guess you're the executive director of the AIC campaign. Chief cook and bottle washer too. So I tell you what we're going to do. I'm going to take a little break here, we'll check in with the Green News Report, and then I'll be back. There might be some dead air, but I'll be back, okay? You're listening to The Horn, a special live remote broadcast from a secure, undisclosed location somewhere in the general vicinity of Washington, D.C., we're up here to work on the Appalachian Communities Health Emergency Act. It's being reintroduced in Congress tomorrow. There will be a hearing a week from today. And we're busting our butts. And you're doing a wonderful job, this community is, reaching out and trying to make our jobs a little bit easier. So thanks for that. And now, Brad and Desi, and I'll be back.
It's Tuesday, April 2nd, 2019.
Mr. Bernhard, I'm not claiming that you are Big Oil's guy. The Big Oil lobbyists are making that claim.
Former oil lobbyist set to be confirmed as Interior Department Chief by U.S. Senate. Federal judge blocks Trump administration expansion of offshore drilling in the Arctic. White House tries unprecedented maneuver to jumpstart Keystone XL pipeline. Plus,
let's just start right now.
Dispatching myths and nonsense at the first ever Green New Deal town hall.
All of those myths and nonsense dispatched straight ahead from bradblog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
These guys have been spilling so much oil in the ocean. Somewhere there's a polar bear being accused of blackface. All right?
Seems only fair. This is your Green News Report. Okay, Desi Doyen, as usual these days, things are looking pretty grim, except there's some pretty darn good news coming out of a court in Alaska.
Yes. In Alaska, a federal judge has restored a ban on offshore drilling across large parts of the Arctic Ocean and deep sea canyons in the Atlantic Ocean that had been implemented by President Obama. The decision immediately reinstates those protections, which had been reversed by President Trump in a 2017 executive order. The judge said the executive order, quote, exceeded the president's authority and that federal law allows presidents to withdraw waters from use, but not to reopen them. Only Congress can do that.
Exactly. That's what the law says, according to this judge. And if Congress wants to change it, they're welcome to do so.
It is a major legal blow to the Trump administration's expansion of offshore drilling. It could also affect Trump's attempt to cut the boundaries of national monuments that have been created by previous presidents. Republican Alaska Senator Lisa Murkowski said the ruling, quote, could have catastrophic impacts for offshore development.
Well, you know what? Offshore development could have catastrophic impact on Alaska. So maybe this is just fine.
Trump also did an end run around the courts to jumpstart the controversial Keystone XL pipeline from Canada. In an unprecedented maneuver, Trump signed a new presidential memorandum authorizing the pipeline to cross the U.S.-Canadian border, bypassing the normal permit process conducted by the State Department. The White House argues this new move emanates from Trump's sole authority as president and is therefore not subject to federal law. Environmental groups have pledged to sue, saying the maneuver sets a dangerous precedent in expanding presidential power over infrastructure. However, the Keystone XL pipeline is still mired in state court in Nebraska.
You mean that thing hasn't been built yet? Donald Trump has announced that it's done about a dozen times.
And we're back on that round again.
I guess so.
Meanwhile, Trump's nominee to head the Interior Department, former oil lobbyist David Bernhardt, blocked the release of a years-long study conducted by scientists at the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service that found three pesticides are so toxic that they, quote, jeopardize the continued existence of more than 1,200 endangered species. That's according to internal documents obtained by the New York Times. Bernhardt previously lobbied against the Endangered Species Act on behalf of the oil and chemical industries, but in his confirmation hearing late last week, when Democratic senators asked him if he would recuse himself from decisions concerning his former clients, this was Bernhardt's response.
I'm basically handcuffed and not in the game for the American people if I am recusing myself. So my view is get in and be on the American team and win for the American team.
So basically he's saying, and he actually says in this hearing, how skilled he is, how wonderful he is, and how it just doesn't make sense to handcuff him and keep him from using those skills, even if he's going to use those skills for the big oil companies who he worked for years.
And Bernhardt is headed for easy confirmation in the Republican-controlled Senate.
Naturally.
Finally, some good news. MSNBC's All In with Chris Hayes devoted a full hour to the Green New Deal resolution proposed by freshman Democratic Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez of New York and Senator Ed Markey of Massachusetts. The resolution is a framework for creating millions of jobs by fighting climate change. The town hall served to debunk some of the worst nonsense perpetuated by Republicans attempting to demonize the plan. Policy architect Rihanna Gunn-Wright explained the social justice component of the resolution.
The Green New Deal ties together climate change and income inequality because the same types of investments that we're talking about in the Green New Deal to tackle climate change are the same investments we have needed to tackle income inequality from the very beginning.
Ocasio-Cortez responded to those claiming that the Green New Deal would cost too much. She said, well, I'll tell you what, why don't we first start by guaranteeing the pensions for retired coal miners? Sounds like a good idea to me. For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. Find us, follow us, and share us planet-wide on the Facebooks and the Twitters at Green News Report. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
Can you hear the death knell toll for old King Cole? Can you hear the death knell toll?
like I said, a little bit of dead air, but not too much. And so we're about the halfway point of the program. And again, I didn't mention it when Bo and I were talking, but we have Shirley's Memorial Challenge on the table this evening. $200 in matching money if we can come up with $200 to go with it. So that's where we stand, and thus far we are at, zero. So if you'd like to double your money, then run on over to headon.live, click on contribute, and the interface, the PayPal interface is, of course, right there. Oh, poor Ralphs. Ralphs says, I wish I had Gwen Moore for my representative, but I have James Sensenbrenner. Puke. And that's so true. Ralph says that's the consequences of gerrymandering. Yeah, indeed. And if you'd like to engage in some conversation, you're more than welcome to do so. This is, of course, Conversation Radio. And that means more than me just, sitting here running my mouth. It's just as if I was in the fabulous Horn Studios of the magnificent Kincaid Mansion. 844-843-4676 gets you toll-free into the program, or 304-574-8178, or Skype to Skype, Bob Kincaid Horn, and it all comes right into the new gizmo that and the whole new traveling rig that y'all put together. And thanks to everyone who did that. Thank you so very much indeed. Trumptanic Tuesday, Trumptanic Tuesday. Where to go? Well, I've got an example. Oh boy, do I have an example. It was a bad day today for Hogan Gidley. Hogan Gidley is a spokes creep for Julius Geezer. And he went on MSNBC today to talk to Hallie Jackson. And Hallie apparently was not in a mood to put up with his crap. Yeah. The issue being, in particular, nasty little hate tweets that the Chlamydia Claudius put out earlier today. Like I said, it did not go well for Hogan Gidley. Come on.
Thing, but a deputy press secretary, Hogan Gidley, has deigned to join us here on set with us today. Hi, Hogan. Great to have you back.
I do deign.
Your second time here with us. And I want to start kind of like we did last time, going over just some factual questions sort of quickly here just to lay some grounds
of the lightning rounds.
So let me start with security clearances and some of these questions on the Mueller report as well. Bill Barr was at the White House yesterday for an event on the First Step Act. Did he speak with the president?
This is as good as it got for poor Hogan. It was all downhill from there until we get to the Puerto Rico part. Let's check in now.
Potentially so. I don't have an announcement for you right here, I can promise you.
I was going to say, that's pretty soft language.
Well, the president's been very clear about what he wants, the principles he set forth. We have to right the wrongs of Obamacare, and now we have a court ruling out there that says the thing could be unconstitutional. He has to protect the American people and give families better choices and more control over.
So I get that, but that's an argument Republicans made in 2018, and it didn't work. There's proof that it didn't work.
Made it in 2010 too, and swept through the House.
So you're thinking it's going to be the 2010 model, not 2018.
No, but this isn't about Obamacare. This is about coming up with something.
It is about Obamacare.
This is about, even Democrats aren't even talking about Obamacare. They're talking about a complete socialist takeover of the health care system.
That's not the case for all Democrats. Let me ask you this.
Socialism, brooga brooga.
8 million people off of their coverage and make private insurance illegal.
Okay, there's a lot to get into on that piece of it. Not all Democrats believe that, first of all. But I want to ask you about other topics as well, in addition to health care, specifically the president's tweets on Puerto Rico that happened this morning, because I think there's some confusion over them. The president says that Puerto Rico got $91 billion for the hurricane. That's not true. Why is he using that number?
They're getting $91 billion that are in pledges to get.
But that's not what the president says. He says they got $91 billion, and half of that is an estimate on what's to come.
Right, and that money is coming to them. The fact is they have received more money than any state or territory in history for rebuild.
That's not true.
100%. There is nowhere that's
even close. Louisiana got more after that hurricane. That's not a true fact.
They have not come to $91 billion with all we've done in that country. They have had a systematic mismanagement of the goods and services we've sent to them. You've seen food just rotting in the ports. Their governor has done a horrible job. He's trying to make political hay in a political year,
right,
and he's trying to find someone to take the blame off of him having a good grid and not having a good system in that country.
These are things that are not true, just factually, from a factual basis, because in Hurricane Katrina, the recovery effort cost more than what's happening in Puerto Rico, and that is estimated to cost. So let's just lay the facts out here. Let me ask you about another fact here. President Trump says that Puerto Rico is only taking from the USA. That's part of his tweet. I think you and I could both agree that President Trump knows Puerto Ricans are U.S. citizens, right?
Correct.
Okay. Does he believe they are not equal U.S. citizens as to folks, for example, in Texas or Louisiana?
That's absolutely ridiculous. I was in the Senate lunch where the president addressed this topic, and he told the people of the United States Senate, you need to vote for this bill. Democrats even want more money than we've already given, $600 million more. It's all of our federal relief packages for future budgets as well. You have to vote for that. It protects the farmers. We have to vote for this and provide the money to Puerto Rico.
Okay, but you're not answering the question. The president says Puerto Ricans are taking from the USA. Puerto Rico is part of the United States. People who live in Puerto Rico are U.S. citizens. You're rolling your eyes, and
correct.
I don't know why you're rolling your eyes, because
correct.
There's a lot of confusion over why the president would say this and what he understands and how he views the people of Puerto Rico.
That's ridiculous. He's actually already traveled to Puerto Rico after this horrific hurricane. He was there.
And then talked a lot of bad things about Puerto Rico ever since he returned.
He gave them a lot of money. They have mismanaged and misused that money. It hurts their people. That's what he's upset about.
The people in Puerto Rico don't think that it hurts them. Well, they believe that they need to have this recovery.
When there are food, goods, and services sitting in those ports and they're just rotting in the sun, that is a complete mismanagement at the government level.
Why hasn't the U.S., why hasn't the White House dispersed the money that Congress has allocated to help Puerto Rico?
I'm sure we will.
When?
I'm not sure. I don't have a deadline for you, but look, they can't even handle what we've given them already. They're letting food rot in the ports.
We're going to have to leave it there for a moment, because I do want to ask you about something else that the president has on his mind, which is this border battle, this issue of immigration that he's been focusing on. We actually do have.
So did you catch the Trump-tanic Tuesday moment in that piece? Did you catch it? That moment when Hogan Gidley refers to Puerto Rico, a part of the United States of America, as that country. You know, that country. Nicaragua, Guatemala, El Salvador, China, Japan, Australia, Puerto Rico, those countries. They're really not making much in the way of an effort to even hide this stuff anymore. And it's kind of, well, no, there's no kind of to it. It's infuriating. It's just another manifestation of the fact that Donald Trump is a white supremacist. But this is a pretty good Trump-tanic Tuesday. Oh, yeah. Without a doubt, because now we have a moment with everybody's favorite serial DUI offender and slimer of children who survived a mass murder, Matt Gaetz of Florida. There's a bill making its way through the House of Representatives called the Equality Act. It's in the House Judiciary Committee. In fact, one of the members that I called on today was actually in the hearing when I was talking to her staffer. What the Equality Act does is it outlaws discrimination based upon gender. Not exactly what you'd call a heavy lift, or at least it shouldn't be here in the penultimate year of the second decade of the 21st century. Yeah. Enter Matt Gaetz, who got into it with Congressman Jerry Nadler, because among other things, the Trump regime and its maggots, its pet maggots in the House, despise Jerry Nadler because Jerry Nadler is in the process of making, Geezer Disgustus and his grifty, sleazy, slimy little family kind of unhappy, because Jerry Nadler is poking around in their finances, and frankly, the Trump family's finances will not withstand just a hell of a lot of scrutiny. So in the course of getting into a bit of a Donnybrook with Gerald Nadler, the chairman, Matt Gaetz professes to be a supporter of the transgender community. But of course, there are always, you know, exceptions.
I now recognize the gentleman from Florida, Mr. Gaetz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For dozens of days, my Republican colleagues have gone to the floor of the House seeking a vote on the Born Alive Act so that human beings are not slaughtered and murdered after their birth. A number of those human beings are women. And so we...
Time out. He's pissing and moaning about a Republican publicity bill that doesn't actually do anything. The Born Alive Act addresses a problem that doesn't exist. But it's the kind of problem that doesn't exist that can get the maggots and the Emrys and the Marvelines out there all whipped up into a big old frenzy. So that's what he's babbling about.
We'll accept no lecture.
Would the gentleman yield for a second
on that subject? Since the minority or since the majority has taken in excess of their time, I'd like to take all of my time, and I do not yield my time.
I'll grant you an extra minute.
Well, very well, then you can take it at the end of my remarks, then, Mr. Chairman. I want to support this legislation, and in the broadest sense, I do. I believe that individuals in our country should not face discrimination for their sex or their gender.
Oh, heck, I just forgot. Get the hockey puck. Because you're going to be hooting like a barn owl by the time this clip is done. Take a couple of trips around with the duct tape, too, just to make sure you don't spin it across
the room. Gender identity. Our country is an inclusive place, and bigotry and prejudice and discrimination don't belong here. I very much want to support the legislation, but I...
Oh, by the way, the inclusive place that America is, and he wants to support the rights of transgender individuals, it's not so inclusive. I was talking with our buddy Reverbo the Human Boy just yesterday, and he told me a transgender woman was murdered there in Maryland just the day before. Of course, it probably happens almost every day. That is, the TG community is one of the most terrorized, most criminalized, victimized minority groups in the country. Just a reminder, but not that that matters much to Matt the Maggot Gaetz.
I can't, because the legislation would only nominally protect certain individuals while causing tremendous harm to others. First off, the legislation has a drafting problem, partly because H.R. 5 does not define gender identity well, and I'll read directly from the legislation. It says, the term gender identity means the gender-related identity, appearance, mannerisms, or other gender-related characteristics of an individual, regardless of the individual's designated sex at birth. And then only a few lines later, the bill says, the term sex includes sexual orientation or gender identity. So gender identity is defined as a concept distinct from sex, but at the same time, the term sex is defined in part by gender identity.
Wait for it.
In the last Congress and in this Congress, we've passed legislation for the advancement of women, improving women's access to STEM education and careers. We've passed bills to increase the number of women-owned businesses, to help female entrepreneurs, and more. What happens when sex is defined as gender identity and gender identity is terribly vague? Will all sex-based distinctions be erased? That may sound like something my colleagues on the other side of the aisle would cheer, but thinking more broadly, would grants for female-led businesses or programs for women in STEM fields suddenly be open to all persons, whether they believe or not that they identify as a woman? I strongly support the rights of transgender individuals. I will not denigrate or deny their existence or their struggles, but I am concerned about the potential of bad actors who would exploit the provisions of this law for their own gain. Consider this possibility: if President Trump were to say, "I am now the first female president," who would celebrate that? Would those who support the legislation think that's a good thing, or would they be dismayed?
Well, the fact of the matter is, we probably wouldn't be shocked. Probably not. Because he does stupid shit like that. But that was a veiled dig at Hillary, too, by the way. They never miss an opportunity to take a sleazy, grifty shot like that. Yeah. Can't make this stuff up. Oh, no. Not at all. Trump-tanic Tuesday. You're going to have this. That's something. I just had a note from Irish Dave. Oh, and thanks. We've gotten a start on Shirley's Memorial Challenge. Thank you, Samson. We now have only $175 to go to finish that off. So thank you very kindly to Samson for that, for getting us started. Now, if we can just have a little company, that'll be great. Irish Dave asking in an email, is Puerto Rico, otherwise known as that country, the fourth Mexico? And I saw that the other day, the Fox font banner, whatever, referencing three Mexican countries. Jesus. Three Mexican countries. You know, Mexico, New Mexico, and Mexico, Missouri. You cannot make this stuff up. So, yeah, it probably is. It probably is the fourth Mexico. But then, of course, there's the other issue. The shutting the border down with Mexico. Buy your avocados now. Because the great avocado crisis of 2019 may very well rival, for the sheer horror of it, the Arab oil embargo of 1973. Yeah. Arab oil embargo. Great avocado crisis. America's 30-somethings going without their avocado toast? Quelle horreur. But then there's another reality, and that's this: car parts. Car parts. Because we have a lot of car parts that come from Mexico. Yeah. Tell you what. Let's see who we have on the stress line. Hey, welcome to the program.
How you doing, Bob?
I'm doing.
Parson Brown.
Hey, Parson. What's happening, brother?
Well, you know, you had me at avocado.
Oh, the horror, the horror.
I actually... What a crisis. I'm actually living in California now, so I feel I've always... It's not like I ever disliked avocados, but I now will eat them on everything. So this is really serious.
Oh, hey, you know what? I was in a little joint in Fayetteville a couple of weeks ago. I had something there I've never had before. Dear God, it was wonderful. Deep, battered deep-fried
like
avocado. Battered, deep-fried avocado.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, I can hear the seriousness in your voice. And it was.
That's some real fusion. That's some real cultural fusion food.
Yeah, because it was like a tempura batter.
Oh, wow.
And then they rolled it up with a bunch of other stuff inside a soft taco.
That sounds amazing.
This happened in West Virginia.
The avocado is the pickle. It's the pickle of the West, so to speak, whereas we pickle everything in Appalachia. And they throw an avocado on anything that you order, and they're kind of delicious.
Oh, you know, if you put a few slices of avocado on a scoop of vanilla ice cream, I'd probably eat it, Parson.
That's pushing it, Bob, even for me.
I mean, you're talking about the guy who's been known to put Crystal hot sauce on vanilla ice cream, so.
Yeah. That's true. That is true.
So what in the world are you doing in California?
Oh, you know, just living the dream, or shall we say extending the arm of our, I'm just taking what I got and stretching it across the continent.
You still doing film? Right now, are you still doing film work?
Yeah, no, I'm working in some television projects, and I'm actually a cartoon voice now coming up, but I can't really talk about it, but so that's fun.
Will you be able to talk about it when it happens?
Oh, yeah, we can talk about it all day long when it happens, but that'll be a little bit.
That's amazing.
I'm so glad. You know, like there was just something that I saw your post that said that you were about to broadcast, and I haven't been able to listen to you just because of my crazy life for quite a while, and it just was like you were calling to me again, Bob. And I'm so glad that I tuned in because the subject matter that you and Bo were talking about just like hit so close to my heart because, you know, I started out, I stepped foot into, you know, the movement to help end mountaintop removal and to, you know, really like the environmental justice movement mm-hmm. when I went to DC for the first time and met so many amazing people like Judy, as you mentioned, and so many others. And
Larry.
Been documenting. Larry, Maria, just Terry Blanton, who's become basically my spirit animal over the years. And so it was good for me. Like, I felt so great to hear that you guys, like, I know that energy of being in D.C., and trying to, you know, push the bill. And I wish you guys the best of luck. And I know that it's not easy. You know, when you describe it to people that haven't been through the process, oh, you went to how many meetings today? Like, that means you have to walk through securities and hallways and wait. And sometimes they throw you into the corner of a, you know, the mezzanine or something. And, like, it's not an easy job being a lobbyist. So I really like.
Yeah. Especially when you're not, especially when you're not the K Street kind of lobbyist who, you know, gets paydays with lots of with lots of zeros in it and, you know, a one in front. No, this is
right. I guess that would put a little spring in your step, wouldn't it? But
it'll put a lift in your shoes. You know,
not to mention that so many, like the time that, well, just to reference what I spoke about earlier, when I, one of my first lobby appointments was with Judy Bonds, and I was so honored. The first time I'd met her, actually, we got assigned to go and lobby a legislation, and we got to the congressman's office, and I won't say his name, but his aide was, it was the most dismissive, like, it was the worst I've ever been treated by anybody in a suit and sneakers. And he just basically just laughed us off. And it was terrible. And, you know, Judy, she managed to level herself somewhere between assertive and not, like, completely destroyed, just, like, exploding in the
because she could have made that guy feel about 2 centimeters tall with next to no effort at all, because Judy did not suffer fools gladly.
No. But that was, like, that was a very important day for me. That was, as soon as we got out of there, was, you know, she turned it up to us and was just like, basically, do you understand now? Do you see what we're up against? And I was like, like, and that was just a turning point for me. Like, I already knew that the fight was on, but I didn't realize how there were so many apathetic people out there on Capitol Hill.
And you know what? I think we've turned a corner on that, Parson, because this freshman class is excited and they really feel like they've been sent there to do a job. Did you happen to catch Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's town hall meeting with Chris Hayes? I guess it was Thursday night, Friday, maybe Thursday, I think.
I did not, but I was listening earlier, and I'm so glad that she's in support.
Well, absolutely. But there was a clip that went semi-viral out of that. And I guess the question, Parson, was something like, how do we deal with climate change? How do we start making this a better country? And her answer was, why don't we just do something? And then she said, by way of example, why don't we start by fully funding the pensions of the retired coal miners in West Virginia? And I thought, whoa, where'd that come from? And I realized then that she really does get it. Because, see, when she talks like that, that's really dangerous for the Republicans that have that have West Virginia in such a death grip. Because,
oh, absolutely. You were mentioning earlier about the rhetoric and the vocabulary that you use even if you're going to announce for office in central and southern Appalachia. You got to be very careful with it, or you'll go nowhere fast.
Sure. Because the industry may not be what it once was, but they still got tons of money.
Yeah. You know, my fist in the air to those that do.
Right.
Say what they need to say, knowing that they're up against the beast. But it's, it's the truth.
Well, let me ask you this. Do you know who your member of the House is out there?
Oh, geez. I don't even know what neighborhood I live in yet. I know that Pelosi's my senator, though.
Oh, so, shit. No. Pelosi is yours?
I mean, she's not my Democrat. We've got Pelosi. I'm going to be contacting her about these avocados shortly.
Yeah, right. Because priorities. Yeah. Find out who your member of the House is and drop them an email and say, hey, bills. And well, wait, you know, why don't you just wait until we've got a bill number and then you can say, hey, sign on to this. Do it yesterday.
Oh, you know, I got you. And another thing is, thinking back on those days when we did used to meet together, large groups of folks would come from all over the country to literally go to training on how to lobby. I'd love to see that again. I'd love to see youth, you know, people of all ages from all over coming to learn how to do lobbying. I took that experience with our Appalachian brothers and sisters when we were in D.C., and I helped facilitate how to lobby in Chicago. And we ended up shutting down two of the oldest, dirtiest coal-fired power plants in the country at the time.
Yeah, that were situated smack dab in the middle of a community of color, naturally.
Oh, yes. And it was one of the densest populations in any urban city, you know, any urban environment in the United States at that time. But it says a lot to be able to, like, to teach young people to know how to speak to, well, to teach anybody to know how to look their representative in the eye and speak their case. So I commend you guys for continuing to do it after all this time. And I'll let you go because I know how tiring it is.
Well, it is that. In fact, I may knock off a little early here because, you know, we got up and hit the ground running at 6 o'clock yesterday morning. We'll probably be doing the same thing tomorrow morning too, because it's that kind
of
work.
We'll get some rest. And oh, I know. Oh, it wears you out.
Well, I'm so glad just to hear from you, Parson. I hope you're doing well. And when you can talk about what this project is, I hope you'll chime back in and give everybody a heads up so we can all watch and listen and you know, take joy in the
success
of a member of our community.
We got a couple projects coming up, so we'll be in touch.
All right.
It was so good to hear you guys. Thank you for the conversation, as always.
Well, Parson Brown, thank you very kindly for checking in. It's been way too long. Don't be such a stranger, all right?
All right. Solidarity, brother.
All right. Later. That's our buddy Parson Brown. I've known Parson for, every bit of 10 years now. And, he knows what it is to do this kind of work, and he knows why this kind of work has to be done, because he's well familiar with the existential disaster that mountaintop removal is. So I tell you what, things being such as they are. And my God, one thing is true. It's spring. It may not be, you know, warm or anything, but it's spring and there is pollen everywhere. And that's why my voice sounds like it does right now. And it's icky. So I think I will, knock off for the time being. And hopefully be back at it tomorrow evening. Remember, I'll be filling in for Malloy Thursday and Friday, so it's kind of dubious as to whether or not there'll be a program then. But in every night that I go live, I will send out a tweet. And before I go, maybe I won't go so fast after all, because there is another story, and it's not funny. In fact, it's tragic. Comes out of East Tennessee. This is a place that is near and dear to me. I'm talking about the Highlander Center in East Tennessee. I saw this earlier today, and it literally made me.
Yeah. How are you doing?
Doing good.
My husband texted me, and he said, I'm about to hop on. And so I was like, I want to get on too.
good.
Yeah, so I could share lots of reflections. I didn't hear the first part about the lobbying you're doing, but I can speculate based on all of the history being involved with lobbying around issues of mountaintop removal in D.C.
Yeah, we are we're really excited because the Appalachian Communities Health Emergency Act is going to be reintroduced tomorrow, and so we are going door to door trying to build support for that bill so that we can end it.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, and I mean, I definitely agree with Parson. Like, we need to, like, capture this moment. It feels like we're in a moment on a lot of different fronts. But, you know, with all this public discussion about, you know, the Green New Deal and trying to make sure that people, former coal miners, have, you know, sustainable jobs and living wage jobs. Like, it just seems like, how can you not talk about mountaintop removal mining at the same time that you're talking about what's the alternative and how do we create a better future? So, yeah, I definitely agree with what you were saying when you were talking to Parson. And I also have reflections and thoughts and a heavy heart related to the news of Highlander and the fire. Yeah, because Highlander has been a part of, you know, my work. And I guess for the folks that may be listening, my backstory is that I was a community organizer in Eastern Kentucky with Kentuckians for the Commonwealth for about 8 years. And, you know, KFTC is a multi-issue organization, but a lot of the work that I was doing was around mountaintop removal mining and, you know, standing in solidarity at the state level with people fighting for mine safety issues. And, you know, I you probably don't know this about where I'm at with my life, but I'm actually a grad student at Penn State, and they might actually give me a degree eventually. But
well, wouldn't that be awesome?
Getting a PhD in it. Yeah, I might actually get out of here before they kick me out. I did a guest lecture today in a undergrad class on conflict, power, and community decision making. And so, yeah, I was telling all kinds of stories about, you know, what it's like to be doing community organizing and building people power, you know, in a region that is very much embedded with the coal industry and a mono economy. And it was really interesting because, like, so most of the folks at Penn State are people, students from around Pennsylvania. And so I was like, at the beginning of the class, I was having them raise their hand, like, where are you from? Like, you know, and did you actually read John Gaventa's book on power and powerlessness? And interestingly enough, many hadn't. But I mean, we had a really fascinating conversation. And I mean, the crux of it is, like, power is the ability to get what you want. And, you know, power doesn't have to be a bad thing. And exactly what you're doing right now with lobbying is you're building the power to make the change so we can have the kind of communities that that we want. So rock on. If I had known that you were there today, I would have shared your story too.
Oh gosh. I would have loved that. Well, for what it's worth, we're here. I guess we're out of here Wednesday morning next, not tomorrow, but a week from tomorrow. So there's going to be plenty of work to do. I'm trying to think of, oh golly. Cause we're not just taking meetings. We're also flyering. And so I'd say we've probably called on, between Bo and me, 60 or more offices of Democratic members of the House, and my feet know every step of it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a beginning. You know, one of the things that we've been telling people, Colleen, about the AIC Act is that it has this wonderful nexus between environmental justice and climate change. And I think that, that's what this has to look like going forward. Because if you impose, I mean, if we try to deal with climate change without trying to have some degree of mercy and compassion for the people who have borne the brunt of the production of these nightmare fuels, then if we were to be completely successful and reverse the heating of the planet, it's not going to come to much. It's sort of like something Van Jones said a lot of years ago at Power Shift in D.C. He said, if we transition to renewable, sustainable energy, and then we're fighting wars over who gets the lithium, we haven't really learned anything, have we?
Right.
And so having that mercy and justice element to it is, I think, a sine qua non. And, you know, we could go even further. Like I said, I'd like to see an Appalachian Marshall Plan. I'd like to see money just poured into Appalachia. If we, for instance, if we created a federal program to reclaim every mountaintop removal site and do it to the absolute state of the art and tell the coal companies just to go to hell, we could employ every heavy equipment operator in the region for a generation, pay them a good wage, and have a good outcome at the end. But the first thing we have to do is stop the destruction and the poisoning in the first place. I mean, does that make sense?
Oh, yeah, totally. I mean, it's so consistent with, you know, the evolution and trajectory of the movement in Appalachia, and, you know, during the last, like, 15 years. Like, when I started with KCC as an intern, it was, gosh, I could probably even remember the date, like, June 13th, 2003. And, you know, I was bright-eyed and bushy-tailed and ready to go, and they, you know, shortly, a couple days later, they had the Flyover Festival, which, you know, brought people from all over the state, like urban, rural, like various race, color, creed, like a beautiful event. I forget how many people were there, but, you know, and then there were volunteer getting people up in the air so they could see the destruction. And I mean, even when you live in, you know, I lived in Perry County and Letcher County, Kentucky, and it's like, there's no way that you can absorb the magnitude of the destruction of mountaintop removal mining without, like, going and seeing it. I mean, it's just, it's like heart-wrenching to see it from the air, because the coal companies do such a good job of trying to, you know, hide it. Although, I mean, I guess they're kind of running out of space, so they can't get away from all the strip mining or doing all the strip mining away from the main road.
Well, yeah, and they've gotten more brazen. It's almost like they don't care if people see it now. They're all, you know, for years it was, right, you know, one ridge back and outside. Well, now in a lot of places down the Coal River Valley and other nearby locations, they're right out to the road and they don't give a damn.
Yeah.
And maybe it's because they feel like they're completely safe. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, and also like what you're saying, I got distracted, and like the Flyover Festival was like the launch of the Canary Project, which I mean, the symbolism there is, like, I think very powerful, of saying, like, you know, Eastern Kentucky, Central Appalachia, West Virginia, East Tennessee, Southern, did I say the four states? Virginia, West Virginia, Tennessee, and Kentucky, you know, have become like the canaries in the coal mine. And we're the, you know, folks that have to or the people, you know, living in the coal fields are the ones that have to, like, say, hey, we're dying. Like, we are straight up dying. Like, okay, maybe it's hard to prove, you know, epidemiologically that, you know, that there are cancer clusters and they're linked to, you know, the strip mining runoff and, you know, the toxins. But, like, the truth is the truth. Like,
absolutely. But, you know, you know, we've learned so much with the course of all of this. For instance, and these are horrifying things to come to realize, Colleen. But by the time that you're opening your tap and something stinking and nasty is coming out of your water faucet, you've probably been you've probably been breathing those airborne particulates for a decade. And so and the other aspect of that is that because of the amount of water pollution that the coal industry has created, you know, from jump 130, 140 years ago, there's no way to trace any water related issues back to a mountaintop removal site because it could be anything. On the other hand, however, the blasting dust can be traced directly back with a bright, bright line. And and the scientists tell us that they're pretty sure that it's those particulates that nobody can see and everybody breathes for 10 or 20 years that are doing the greatest degree of harm. And so they, you know, they've wrecked everything. But at least we finally have enough of a science, a handle on the science, to be able to point to a cause. And that really does change everything. You know, Dr. Michael Hendricks did some of the most groundbreaking work in this field. And if you go, if you just go to a search engine and type in Michael Hendricks, H-E-N-D-R-Y-X, and TED Med, T-E-D-M-E-D, 20 minutes on mountaintop removal, that for anybody, any of your friends who have never heard of the issue, you show them that video and they will be gobsmacked.
So it's a YouTube video?
Yeah, I mean just it'll pop up as a TED Med talk. You know, a TED talk about medicine. So it's called TED Med and just Michael Hendricks mountaintop removal in any search engine and it'll pop up.
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree. Like, Hendricks' work has been so important to, like, demonstrate what people living in the coal-producing regions have known all along, or many of them, if they, regardless of whether or not they want to acknowledge it. Like, there's higher cancer rates. There's, like, but I think it was a Hendricks research study where that came out a few years ago about the infant mortality rate being higher in coal producing counties. Am I remembering? I can't remember if it was him or another
and
one. But
you know the birth defects
study I'm talking about.
The birth defect study, of course. Because birth defect rates in mountaintop removal areas are almost mind boggling.
Yeah.
And it's a moral issue for our time.
Right. Well, and I think it's also really telling that with Reverend Barber and the Poor People's Campaign that they came to Harlan County and, like, this is a part, it's not just a Appalachian issue. It's not just a, you know, environmental justice issue. It's like a human rights issue. And people, regardless of which community you live in and how you're getting screwed over and oppressed, like, extreme energy extraction is affecting all of us, whether it's like what Carson was saying with the, you know, the Little Village environmental group.
Right, right.
Group. I forget. if I got that name right, but like, you know, poor people of color in inner city Chicago. You know, I mean, I was talking about this today in the class, like, you know, like, don't buy the hype. Like, nuclear power is not a good solution for global climate change. Like, just thinking about uranium mining and people living in, you know, native people that live in the Four Corners region. I mean, the stories, like, I don't know if you knew about this or remember this part of the work over time, but there was a group of folks from the Four Corners that came down to Eastern Kentucky, and I don't even remember what year
remember.
It was.
I do remember.
I mean, the stories, yeah. Yeah, it was like the stories that they were sharing. I mean, I was up in Letcher County in Yola, and I mean, the stories are the same. It's like what Terry Bland says, is like, same story, different holler. And like, if y'all don't have a holler, then you got something, you know?
Yeah.
Like, I'm in Pennsylvania, central Pennsylvania right now, and it's like, fracking's another part of the story. Like, in all of these different ways, this manifestation of fossil fuels is killing us, and it's killing the planet, and it's killing our families, and we need to move past it. And also, by the way, Parson messaged me back, and he figured out that his congressperson is
Tony Cardenas.
Cardenas.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I just saw that in the chat room.
So he's going. Yeah. So he's going to call as soon as the bill's introduced. And in terms of my congressperson, we actually have a vacancy. I'm in the. Let's see here. They just like gerrymandered everything, or they said that they were fixing it. But so like in State College, which is a booming metropolis of 50,000 people, but then you add the Penn State students and then it becomes close to 100,000. They split our community to in Congressional District 12 and Congressional District 15. And so the district that I'm in, the Republican, like renounced his seat. And so there's a special election on May 21st, and I'm going to be sure to talk to Mark Friedenberg about the Democrat running, about how he
do please
address this issue.
You know, it's interesting you mentioned a vacancy. One of the floors of one of the buildings I was on today, you know how it looks when you're walking through the House office buildings. You know, there's the bronze plaque on the door with the name and the state and the district, right? Well, I happened on one that looked like nothing, no other office I'd seen. There's the American flag standing by the door like there always is, and it says, Office of the 9th Congressional District of North Carolina. That is the seat that the Republican got caught cheating trying to win. And and so instead of doing the right thing and giving the guy who actually won the seat, they're making him run for it all over again. And then the Republicans are running an absolute Lulu of a Looney Tunes cartoon character. And he's probably got a fighting chance. But the thing is, I looked at that and I thought, you know, yeah, you only get that because of the way and remember, the guy who won the race by a narrow margin was a Baptist minister, and he got caught stone cold cheating on absentee ballots. And so the people of North Carolina's 9th district have no representation. And it just, you know, because Republicans can't help cheating. They're in a very bad they're in a very bad mood now that they're in the minority. They're downright cranky, and it makes me very very happy, Colleen. Because those were a lot of years. Those were a lot of years in the wilderness. And the idea that we may pass this bill just fills me with joy. And then we can go to work on what happens in 2020. So, yeah, it's worth the work. It's hard work,
yeah,
but it's worth it.
oh, yeah. Well, and it's like, you know, my buddy Carl Schuch, the former UMWA organizer, is like, you know, this it can also be fun. And like Lenny Combs would say, like, I feel like Parson and I were talking, and we talk all the time, but I feel like he was saying, or maybe I ran into Sandra Diaz and Matt Lawson in Asheville a couple weekends ago. The Appalachian Studies Conference was down there. And you know, so at Voices and like just, I mean, you know, there's so much history to the organizing and the movement building. And it's just kind of a beautiful thing to be a part of this history. But in terms of like Carl saying, you know, it's like, well, I guess we got to find some fun in this. And I'm messing. I can't quite remember the quote that he has said before, but it's something along the lines of like, you got to be a little bit kooky to be involved with social movement organizing, but, you know, I guess we're both kind of kooky to think that this is also fun in the fact that like we have the ability to make change. And also
it's interesting you would mention Carl Schuch, because he's going to be testifying at the hearing a week from today.
Yeah.
And I'm sure he'll do a great job.
Yeah. I mean, one of my favorite quotes of Carl, and I said it in class today, I say it all the time, is like, you know, coal mining is a part of our past, it's part of our present, but it doesn't have to be a part of our future. So it's like,
exactly, because
and, it, and I also just think about like, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, because if it's part of our future, there is no future.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I tell you what, Colleen, it's been great talking to you. How far are you from being done with your degree?
About a year. I'm actually going to be hightailing it out of here back to Eastern Kentucky to collect my data. I'm looking at social movement learning in just transition. So,
oh, wow.
Yeah, so I get to go back and hang out with Carl and Stanley and I call them the Harlan County Fab Five. So it's like Rory Silver, Benny Massey, Rutland, Mountain, Carl.
Nice.
And so, yeah. It's like, you know, that you've got like good people in your corner when like your friends are a bunch of retired coal miners, deep miners. But the other thing before you, I don't know how long you're on here, but before you sign off, like I've been reflecting a lot about the fire at Highlander as well. And I actually just wrote, you know, like I don't know, made a recommendation or whatever you do on Facebook to affirm that you, like an organization. And I was just, it just like brought back all these memories of like, you know, how honored I was to like be able to go to the 75th anniversary and like thinking about the history of Highlander, you know, not just about how instrumental Highlander has been around issues in Central Appalachia, but also the Deep South and the civil rights movement and, you know, like Rosa Parks and Septima Clark and, you know, Martin Luther King Jr., like all of these amazing, amazing leaders going there and coming together and like learning together across lines of difference. I mean, I've just been, you know, thinking about that a lot, and especially with the fact that they just released, you know, that most likely the fire was related to white supremacy. And but then the other thing too is like you know, Rory Silver's on a board and he has messaged me over the last week about some updates, and he said, well, it's not stopping us, you know, there are 55 people up on the hill this weekend learning and growing together around prison reform. So, you know, like we're in this moment where, you know, Trump has created this kind of like toxic whatever that that makes it okay to be a white supremacist or overtly racist or whatever, but like we're fighting back, you know, like the sign that I held at the Women's March in DC was like, and it like was kind of interesting how many media people were like picking up on it or like interested to like interview me I mean, I was also like up in her face holding my sign that said rural, not racist, you know, because the thing is that like, okay, sure, there are some people that are racist and horrible in the South, and they also are in the North, and they're also like all over the country. And just because they exist does not mean that they own this moment and that we're going to fight back against that. I mean, I've also been thinking about, like, I don't know if you had heard this, but about a week ago in State College, a young African-American man was shot by the police. And he was in a mental health crisis. And so it's like, how does this happen in our country when somebody, you know, more than likely it was a suicide hotline that like directed the cops to, you know, go follow up with this person with a mental health warrant or a 302. And like, they knew that they were going into a situation where somebody was like in a mental health crisis. Like, why are you not going to do everything that you can? Why are you not anticipating that there might be some escalation? And why are you not making sure that, like, okay, and they've been like, the cops have been posturing and whatever, saying, well, you know, we go above and beyond. We, you know, we do crisis intervention training, and we do implicit bias training. And it's like, okay, cool. I'm glad that you do that. And it's not mandatory, but like, still, a young black man was just shot 4 times, and all he had was a knife, you know? And so, and then also this like rural, not racist thing. I mean, by like technical definitions, State College is not rural, but it's rural-ish or, you know, whatever. But, I mean, it's like a, you know, there's, it's probably more diverse than an average community this size. Surrounded by a lot of rural areas or rural communities because of Penn State, and there are a lot of international students. But like, it's a pretty white community, and
oh yeah,
and it's just like, it's just shaking everyone to our core. And so like, the stuff that Highlander is about is stuff that I'm thinking like, how do we get folks to come up? You know, it's like, and it's, the co-director at Highlander and I are good friends, and we were talking about like, you should come up here. But then with everything that's happened, like, you know, like we need to like band together and say like, wait, am I allowed to swear on here?
Oh yes, no, quite.
We don't go. Like, I don't know how to communicate without swear words on some of these.
No,
things,
you're more than welcome. This is the internet. We can speak as we see fit. Or sometimes okay. we just have a fit.
But it's like, I mean, had you heard about the like?
No, I had not heard that particular story in conjunction with the Highlander Center story. I was going to mention that two African American churches in Louisiana have burnt in the last week. And
oh my gosh.
And sometimes I get this sense, you know, these white supremacists, these jackasses, these vicious punks, they talk, oh, there's going to be a new American Civil War in there, and it's like they're damned well determined to get it started whether we want to participate or not. And it feels like, you know, burning the Highlander Center, torching black churches, it feels like It's part of it. It feels like part of a piece of it.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's like, where is Trump going to be on this? Like, this is domestic
Well,
terrorism.
there are some very fine church arsonists, very fine people.
That's where he's going to be.
Oh my goodness, that was a really good impersonation.
Yeah, I hate myself for it. It gives me nightmares. Well, I tell you what, Colleen, it's been a great conversation. Good luck finishing the degree. Yeah. Good luck going back to Kentucky. Stay in touch, and hopefully we'll talk again soon. Don't be a stranger.
Yeah, sounds good. Take care. Good luck on the hill.
All right. Thanks so much. Bye now. And calling from PA, that's Colleen. And I am. I'm worn out, and I'm going to... I'm going to knock off. We had a glitch of some sort a little bit ago, but we got the program back, and I'm glad of it. So we still have $175 to go on Shirley's Memorial Challenge. Hopefully, maybe that'll happen overnight. It would be great if it did. And I'll try to be back here tomorrow evening. Okie doke? Okie doke. So thanks to all of you who share in your precious finite time engaging in this little conversation. Thanks to all of you who keep the program going. Thank you, Samson, for jumping in this evening on Shirley's Challenge. Hopefully you'll have some company overnight. Thank you again to Ralphs and to our buddy Laborman and to the other anonymous person who makes Shirley's Challenge possible at the beginning of every month. Thanks to our all-volunteer staff. Thank you to Sparky in the chat room. Thank you to our news ninjas. Thank you, Brother Deacon Asa, headon.live. Thanks to John Fox in Australia. Thank you, Ben Birch, whiterosesociety.org. And thanks to the hardest-working, bravest people I know, the men and women of Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net. 20 years in the forefront of the struggle for environmental justice and human dignity in Appalachia. And always, 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 Gina, it's all for you. Later, y'all.